Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, we'll meet the only shooting sports star in the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame. In between two Olympic gold medals, he served two tours in Vietnam.
I'm laying there and I hear the drone come in and hit the Jeep. The Jeep wasn't more than 20 yards from me. Blew up and was burning.
We'll hear about his 26 years in the Army, and as the world focuses on Sochi, we'll talk Tokyo, Mexico City, and Munich with an Olympic legend. Today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our veterans, normally World War II veterans, but we're going to throw you a curveball today, and I think it's fitting as everyone focuses in on the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, that we will be joined today by a three-time Olympic medalist. Two of those medals are gold medals. He's also a veteran of the U.S. Army, 26 years in the service, retired as a lieutenant colonel, and continues to serve our country by training Olympians of today and tomorrow. Lonis Wigger of Colorado Springs, Colorado, our guest today, but originally from Carter, Montana. How big is Carter, Montana?
Oh, that's a big place. We don't even have a service station. And we have a bar part of the time. I suppose a couple hundred people.
So growing up there, what was life like growing up in the 1940s and 50s in Carter, Montana?
Well, I don't remember too much about the 40s, but the 50s, I grew up on a farm. My dad was a wheat farmer, lived about 12 miles out in the country from Carter. And I attended grade school in Carter most of the time. One or two years, I went to school to Fort Benton, which is the next little town down the way, which has about 3,000 people, I think, or something along that line, and that's where I ended up going to high school, too.
Do you remember what your earliest Olympic memories were? Would the 1948 games be the first games you remember, or can you even put a finger on that when you first grasped this concept of these worldwide competitions, the Olympic Games?
No, not really. I grew up as a target shooter, and I knew that shooting was a sport in the Olympic Games. And I had something like a long-range goal way out that hopefully someday I could be on the U.S. Olympic team. You didn't get much by the way of news. The TV wasn't really prevalent at that time, so you really didn't hear a whole lot. And, of course, you never heard anything about what happened with the shooters, so I really didn't know anything until I got in the Army.
You might have heard about a 17-year-old named Bob Mathias winning the Olympic decathlon in London in 48, but nothing about the shooters. But at that point you said, well, someday I'm going to be the only shooter in the Olympic Hall of Fame, right?
No, I don't think the goals quite went that far, but I came here to the training center, Olympic Training Center, after I retired from the Army in 1987, and Bob Mathias was running the training center at that time. So I did actually get a chance to meet him.
Well, folks listening to this program know him full well from his days growing up in Tulare in the San Joaquin Valley, long way from Carter, Montana. So, and you mentioned getting into the Army. Now, your first military experience would have been at Montana State?
Right. I enrolled and took ROTC. Of course, at that time, everybody, all the males, had to take 2 years of ROTC, so it was mandatory. It wasn't a matter of you wanting to. But I took the first 2 years, and then I decided that I wanted to go ahead and get my commission and go on active duty, because by that time I had heard a lot about and knew a lot about the U.S. Army's marksmanship training unit at Fort Benning, Georgia, and knew they were training soldiers to be shooters, international shooters, which meant world championships, Olympics, and so on, if they were good enough. So by that time I had pretty much set my goal that I wanted to be a part of the marksmanship unit at Fort Benning, because it was the only real opportunity that anybody had at that point in my sport to train. Yeah, that was my goal, to get that commission and go on active duty and get to Fort Benning.
And what was it about shooting that really drew you in? Because a lot of kids, I'm sure, growing up in Montana like to hunt and fish, or maybe they like to play some football. But what was it about shooting that really made you gravitate toward it?
Well, I've always liked athletics. I was really a big baseball fan back in the 50s, and I St. Louis Cardinal, and I had all the players and their averages, and I knew everything about all of them. And
Stan the Man, your favorite?
Oh, yeah. And so really it was baseball, but in high school didn't have a baseball program. All they had was football and basketball. And I would have loved to have played one of the two, but I wasn't hardly big enough. 5'4 and 150 pounds, that's not much of a football player, and not quite tall enough to be a basketball player. So shooting was my outlet, the opportunity that I had to excel in something athletically. My father was a target shooter, and we had a rifle club there in Carter, Montana. We shot in the basement of the community hall, and they had been shooting since the 1930s with their club. And so it was kind of natural for me to gravitate into the program, and I started when I was about 10 or 11 years old. No junior program at that point, but just trained with the seniors, and I shot in the local league matches with the seniors and some of the tournaments and so on. That's really how I learned.
You mentioned your father being a shooter. I guess he would have been one of your role models. Was there anybody else in the shooting world that you looked up to or said, yeah, I want to be like that person?
No, I don't really think so. At that point, I didn't know of any shooters in the United States that, you know, had really won medals and so on, so I really had none to look up to. I had met several of the shooters. When I went to Montana State, I also shot on their rifle team, ROTC team, and the varsity team. And we went to some of the matches around in the West to shoot. And it's one year we went to El Paso, Texas to shoot this big collegiate competition. The Army Marksmanship Unit sent a crew out to the competition to put on a clinic, because they're recruiting too. And so that's where I got to meet some of the famous Army shooters at that point. It's about 5 or 6 of them there, and we got to visit with them and talk with them and so on. And if I didn't know before, I knew after that that was my goal, to get on that team, do what I could to get there. So that was what I started, you know, really working for from that point on.
And how long was it till you accomplished that goal?
Well, I think that was about 1958 when I went to that clinic, but graduated in June of 1960, got my commission in infantry branch, and then waited to go on active duty in February 61. At that point, I was married and already had a child, and so we loaded the car and went to Georgia. I went to the officer's basic course, infantry basic course first, which at that time was only like 2 or 3 months, and then I had orders to go to the marksmanship unit right after the school was over. So I went over and signed in, and the day I signed in, the captain in charge of the team took me in to meet the colonel, the commander of the unit, marksmanship unit, and this was like in end of March, first part of April, something like that. And that's the time of year in the winter when we always shot our indoor sectional championships, and that's where you shoot different places in the country and they compile your scores to pick your indoor champions. And I always shot that competition. Well, I didn't get to shoot that year because of the school, and I asked the captain who was in charge, I said, is there any, they were leaving to go to Morgantown, West Virginia to shoot the sectional that weekend. I said, is there any way that I could go on that trip? I really would like to shoot that sectional. He says, well, I don't know. He says, let's talk to the colonel. So I went in and met the colonel and everything, and he says, Lieutenant Wigger here wants to go to Morgantown and shoot with the team this weekend, shoot the indoor sectional. He said he's willing to pay his own way and take leave if need to go shoot. And the colonel kind of looked at me and he says, well, we don't take leave to go shoot around here. He says, we pay the way. So he asked the captain, he says, how'll he do? Will he be the low shooter? And Captain Atwood, he says, no, I don't think so. He said, all right, put him on orders. So I got to go. And I wasn't a low shooter. I was about the middle of the pack. But that was my beginning in the marksmanship unit.
I've got to ask you, because for people that listen to this show, and for me doing the show, most of the guys I talk to, as I said, are World War II guys. So they knew, for the most part, some of them were in before the war. Even then, they had an inkling something was happening. And for those drafted during the war, they knew what they were getting into. For you, I mean, you were just a kid when World War II happened. You're just turning into a teenager when the Korean War was going on. So here in the early 1960s, as you're in the Army and in this marksmanship unit, did you have any inkling that you might be headed overseas to fight a war as you eventually would?
No, that never crossed my mind. Really, at that time, we weren't heavily involved in Vietnam yet. And we had some advisors over there and working with them and so on, but it didn't really blow up for a couple more years. So then obviously we knew that things were going to happen. I had a 2-year commitment as a reserve officer, and when my 2 years was up, I decided to get out because I wasn't shooting that good. I figured that they were going to send me somewhere, and I really didn't have any thought of making the Army a career. I wanted to shoot. You know, the way things looked, I didn't think there was any chance that I was going to get any better at it. So, although I did make the Pan American game team in the spring of 63, I made it in Prone somehow. I lucked out and made the team and went to Brazil and won the silver medal. And I figured that's probably the only international competition I'll ever get to go to, and probably the only medal I'd ever win. So I figured, oh, now's probably a good time to get out. So the spring of 63, we had a European training trip. Not a lot of competitions, but we'd go to Europe and we'd shoot against different countries and so on. And we'd end up going to the factory where the firearms were built, because most of our shooters wanted to use European firearms. We used Remingtons at the time I tried out, and they just weren't good enough. And when I went to Europe that spring, I went to the Walther factory and bought a Walther free rifle. And I got out of the Army and went back to Montana. Figured I'd probably end up going back to school in Bozeman to get my master's degree and go on and get a job in my major, which was agronomy. But that summer, I traveled quite a bit and shot matches. I went to Canada and shot a match and won that. Then I ended up going to Camp Perry, Ohio, which is the home of our National Rifle Association championships. Not international shooting, but NRA shooting. I won the three-position championship there that year with my new rifle. And I borrowed a rifle from an old shooter from Idaho, and I won the prone championship with his gun. So I won both of them that year, first time anyone had won both in the same year. So when I got back from Camp Perry in August, I thought, you know, I'm starting to shoot a little bit better. Well, I got a letter from the Army, and it said that if you want to come back on active duty, you'll notify us within 6 months when you got out. And I said, I qualify, I've only been out 5 months. I said, if I come back in, where do you send me? He said, where do you want to go? Well, obviously, I said, I want to go to the marksmanship unit in Fort Benning. I said, okay. I said, all right, I'm back in. And I started training again. And the unit got in 3 new Anschutz rifles from Germany, rimfire small bore rifles. So I drew one out and started shooting it. It seemed like every time I shot it, I shot better. It was like I had the wrong gun all along. I had the right one now. And I shot very good all winter long. And we went to Europe in the spring for matches. And I went to the Anschutz factory and bought a new rifle there. So we shot the Olympic trials. I used the unit Anschutz, not my new one yet. I didn't take it out of the case yet. But anyway, I used the unit one, shot the small bore trials. I ended up tied for second place. And they take 2 people. So they weren't sure how they were going to break the tie. They didn't know what they were going to do. So finally they decided we're going to come back tomorrow and we're going to shoot a half course. And normally the course of fire is 40 prone, 40 standing, 40 kneeling. So we decided we'd shoot a half course, 20, 20, 20. I had a big party in my house that night because it was supposed to be the end of the trials and all the shooters come over there and have a party. Well, I had to have the party, but I was very careful with what I did. The fellow that I was tied with, he didn't bother to come. He stayed home. So the next day we went out, and I think everybody that was there shooting and had been at my house all came to the range to watch. We had a crowd of, I would guess, around 40 or 50 people watching us shoot that half course. I won the half course by 7 or 8 points, and I made the Olympic team. Jim Hill, the Marine Corps, had won a silver medal in the Olympics in 1960 in Rome with a non-shoot prone rifle, and he loaned me his rifle to take with me, and I shot his rifle prone over there. I shot the 597 prone, which was 2 points over the world record, and tied with the Hungarian. And he Creedmoored me. He beat me in the last stand. He had 100, and I had a 99, so he got the gold, and I got the silver. We both got world records. But that was with the borrowed gun. And then in the three-position match, I used his gun prone and my gun for standing and kneeling, and won a gold medal and set the world record and won the match by 12 points. It just seemed like everything that year clicked. Like I said, every time I shot, I seemed to get better. And then it took me a couple of years after that to get let down and come back and shoot where I should. When you win something big like that, you know, you've accomplished your goal. At that point, you don't have goals, and you're kind of floating, and you really don't know, what do I do now? You either quit, or you reestablish goals, and you go again. But it usually takes a while, and it took me 2 or 3 years to actually get over that and start get back in the game competitive. In 1966, we went to Wiesbaden, Germany and shot the world championships. And when I got back, I had orders for Vietnam.
Let me ask you a little bit, because I'm sure people at home, especially now that they're watching the Olympics on TV, the Winter Olympics, they're curious about that Olympic experience. It's 50 years ago now in 1964. And I know there are some pretty good basketball players on that Olympic team, some pretty good boxers, track stars. What was it like for you to have that gold medal placed around your neck? This kid from Carter, Montana, here you are in Tokyo. You were a boy when Tokyo was getting bombed by Doolittle's Raiders, and here you are standing on the podium getting the gold medal. What was that moment like for you?
Well, it was unreal. I mean, the whole trip the year before getting there and being someone who had really very little experience, and unknown. Nobody knew me at all. Normally, to go in and do something like that, you've had to have years of experience behind you and accomplishment, so on. Somehow, it all came together for me. I wish I knew why, but yeah, it was unbelievable getting the medals. And my dad was there. He attended the games with me, so we did things together at night and so on. And so, it was just a real proud moment for him to be there and for me to win. I really don't know why. I don't know why it all came together for me when it did. We're just lucky.
What about other Olympians? Did you rub shoulders with any of those famous names on that 64 Olympic team? Do you have some memories of walking through stadiums or seeing people here and there?
I met a few, but not really. You were in the village. You lived in the village, but most of the famous ones lived in hotels. They didn't stay in the village with the rest of us. But I did get to see some of the other events. I went to the track event, and I saw Bob Hayes run the last leg of the 400. When he took the baton, he was behind, and he blew the guy out and won. They say it was the fastest leg ever run. So I got to see that. And I don't know if you remember Billy Mills or not. He was no favorite either. He wasn't supposed to do anything. The Australian, I think it was, or New Zealand, I'm not sure which, was the favorite, and he was supposed to win. And I talked to Billy Mills after that. As a matter of fact, we were on a TV show in New York that next winter. I've Got a Secret. And he and I were there, two lieutenants that were on a rowing. Each of us were a lieutenant in the different military. So we had the Navy and the Air Force and the rowers. Billy was the Marine, I was the Army. All lieutenants, and all had won gold medals. And they had to guess our secret. Well, they obviously didn't guess it. But I got to talk to him some there, too. And his story was kind of like mine in a way. He says, I don't know why I won. He said, I went into that last turn. And he said, I was this far behind, and, there wasn't really any way I was going to catch. He says, all of a sudden, it was just like it was ordained. I got the second wind, and I just took off and won the gold medal. I think he's kind of like me. He probably still doesn't know to this day why. But it was pretty interesting talking to him.
Here they come down the final out. Can Ron Clark catch the Moody? They're going through the field. He's coming up. He's passing the Moody.
Look at Bill. Look at Mills. Look at Mills.
Coming on. Mills is coming on.
Oh, no.
Tremendous surprise here. Bill Mills of the United States wins the 10,000 meters.
Bud Palmer and Dick Bank on NBC back in 1964 describing Billy Mills' improbable gold medal. Our guest today, Lonis Wigger, has described his own unlikely path to the top of the podium in Tokyo 50 years ago. But when we come back, we'll explore his Army experiences during the Vietnam War. This Olympic-themed edition of Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. One of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 76-year-old Lonis Wigger, two-time Olympic gold medalist marksman and the only shooting sports competitor to be inducted to the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame. Originally from Carter, Montana, he lives in Colorado Springs, Colorado now. That, of course, is home to the U.S. Olympic Training Center, where he volunteers his time to help the shooters of today and tomorrow. Olympic athletes now can devote nearly every waking hour of every day to what becomes a real consuming pursuit. And Lonis Wigger is as determined and disciplined as anyone. But let's put it in perspective. Early 1967, Lonis Wigger is 29 years old. He has a wife, three young children. He already has an Olympic gold medal in three-position small-bore rifle, a silver in the prone event when you lay down flat on your stomach and fire bullseyes. Both of those medals earned in the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. But now he receives orders to go to Vietnam. Hard to imagine one of our Olympic heroes today heading over to Iraq or Afghanistan, isn't it? What was it like for you heading to Southeast Asia, not knowing whether you'd ever see your wife and kids again?
Well, it was tough. Actually, it was probably a lot tougher on her than it was me for that year, because she was responsible for taking care of three young kids and maintaining the household and the whole thing while I was gone for that year. I actually was assigned to MACV, which is Military Assistance Command, and I was sent to the Delta to a small outpost. I think we had about 50 people in our compound. Started out, I worked with the ag people, advising with them, and we had very few roads in the Delta where I wasn't drunk in. And if you traveled, you usually went by sampan. So I'd go out, and today we'd go out with the ag advisor, and we'd cut down the canals in the sampan and get way in the hell out there somewhere and have lunch with the locals. And I was probably too dumb to realize I shouldn't have been out there. And I didn't even have a radio with me or anything. All I had was a little M2 carbine, which is, if you shot somebody with it, all it would do is probably tick them off. It wouldn't hurt them any. But I remember one time having lunch with the village chief and seven or eight others, and I had a little interpreter with me, a young kid about 16, and we were sitting around this big table, and they had a big pot in the center, and they dipped out some food on our plates, and I didn't know what it was. It was meat, but I didn't know what it was. So I picked it up and ate it around the bone and so on, and there were these little plastic V's that I found. I don't know what they were. I laid them on my plate, and so I wasn't in the conversation because I didn't speak Vietnamese, but well, I'm bad, I'll get me another piece. So I dipped in the big bowl and come down and brought up. It was a chicken head. And then I saw what the little V's were, their beaks. So I looked around, nobody saw me. I put it back in and pushed it down and looked around, got something else and brought it out and ate it. But it was a pretty good experience. And I really enjoyed that tour. It was a lot of fun working with the Vietnamese. And later on, I was the advisor to the RFPF training center, which was there. That's with the lower level Vietnamese troops, and I went out and operated with them some too. It was a pretty good tour. I was glad it was over with, though.
Your story is really unique, because I don't know how many people can claim to have won an Olympic gold medal, gone over to Vietnam, come back, gone to another Olympics, and then gone back to Vietnam again, and then another Olympics, and another Olympics. So was it different for you going to Mexico City now that you have been to Vietnam and back, experienced some of that, and everything you'd been through at that point? Was it different than that eye-opening experience you had in Tokyo?
No, not really. I mean, it was your goal always to make the Olympic team. And, of course, at that point, it's not only the goal to make the team, it's the goal to win. I got back in February of 68. In fact, I came right out right in the middle of the Tet invasion, if you remember hearing anything about that. I was able to get to Saigon. And I was at this little hotel. We were going to leave the next day. And I saw them putting airstrikes in at the racetrack, which is like 2 miles away. You could see all that. We were up on the top floor watching it. And I went out the next day, and the airplane was only half full because people that were supposed to be with us on that date couldn't get there. So I was fortunate. I got to get out about 3 days early. I got back in February, and then we had our trials in the spring for the 68 Olympic Games. And we had the trials in Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. I was leading going into the third day. Different squatting on the third day. They squatted us in order of where we placed. So I was squatted on point one, and Tommy Poole, who had been my teammate in Tokyo, was squatted on point two. You're shooting out of this small building. Just inside of the building was point one, so the building ended right there. Well, the wind was coming from behind, and it was whipping around the building and down the firing line, and the people on the end didn't work very well. The wind ate us up. The people that made the team actually were like fifth and sixth in line that day. So, yeah, I felt like I should have been there, and I should have been on top of my game. As it ended up, I got to go and shoot the prone, the 60-shot prone match. And I shot all right, but I didn't shoot very well, so I didn't win anything the next day. I was pretty disappointed, though. I didn't get to shoot the big match that I wanted to shoot in.
Just curious, because I wasn't alive for the 68 games, but everything I've seen and read about it, you hear about the tension that was starting to build, and we've seen Tommy Smith and John Carlos with their black gloved fists raised in the air. How did you experience all of that as a member of this Olympic team and someone who's been overseas fighting for your country, that there was this tension within America at that time? What do you remember about that?
Well, I can remember news reports and so on about them, but, you know, they were, I wasn't associated with them. I wasn't in the village all that much except to sleep when we were out doing something. So I never really got involved in the whole thing. I know that before the games, though, they'd had protests there, and a lot of people had been shot to put down the protest and get things a little bit back to normal. So when we went there for the games, it went pretty well. I'm sure the security was tight, too, but we didn't really seem to have any problem. But as far as what you were talking about, I wasn't involved, and I really didn't even think about it. It just wasn't something that involved me, and I really had very little interest in it. I was more involved in what we were doing.
I know we're going to get to 72 and what happened there and your unique perspective on all of it, but before that, you had to go back to Vietnam. Was that tough to swallow, being sent back to Vietnam? I mean, I'm sure when you were there in 67, you were hoping it would be over soon, and then you're going back 4 years later. The thing is still going on, and you've got to leave behind your wife and kids again. What do you remember about that second tour?
Well, I remember when I went the second time, I made up my mind I wasn't going to go the third time, that I'd get out before I would go again. The Army was starting to send sniper training teams into the larger units, Army units in Vietnam, usually division level, and they had gone in, I think, first one went in about 2 years before that, probably around 1969. So we were getting ready to send sniper training teams to the Maricao and the 101st Airborne. My good friend Jack Foster, who had been on the Mexico Olympic team with me, was picked to take be the OIC officer in charge of the 101st team, and I was picked to take the team to the Maricao division and replace the team that was over there in country. We'd go in and replace them. So I went through sniper school, sniper training, and I had a crew of about 8 or 10 instructors, sergeants, and all of them had shooting backgrounds. And so I was kind of looking forward to going on this tour because I felt like I'd be doing something, you know, I knew a little bit about, and I thought it would be a little better tour. No, I really didn't want to go, but it didn't bother me near as much to go the second time because I knew that it would probably go pretty quick, the whole tour, and I should enjoy it, and I would be enjoying what I was doing. So we went in country in January of 71. Coming to Saigon, well, there was a sergeant there that had used to be in a marksmanship unit, and he knew we were coming, and he met us at the plane, and somehow they got our whole team transferred to go to a Vietnamese unit and build a sniper school and train them and arrange for them. So we spent the first 2 months just north of Saigon at a Vietnamese training camp and built a range, trained instructors, and did the whole thing. And then after that, then we went to Chu Lai, which was up on the coast, replaced the team that was there. Actually, they'd already gone the time we got there. So we started out, and then we started training snipers for the AmeriCal, maybe 20 a month. We'd have like a three-week training period. We'd train that many, and then they'd go to the field. And in the meantime, the ones that were out in the field, they would come in, they got a chance. They'd come back to our area, and the gunsmith would go over their guns, and they'd stay a couple of days with us, and all the sergeants, the cadre, all their stories, and then they'd be back to the field. So we had like 151 snipers in the field at the time, so we had quite a few out there. But in 1971, there wasn't a lot of contact with the enemy. Things had died down quite a bit. There was no contact unless they wanted to have contact, so there wasn't a whole lot of sniping going on in that particular year. I had one sniper killed in action while I was there, but they employed him completely wrong, and they left him in too long, and should never have happened. But I enjoyed the tour. It was a lot of fun. I don't know if you ever saw the TV show McHale's Navy. Well, pretty much like that. And in order to get by, you had to trade something. We had an electric welder that the other team had managed to trade the CBs when they were there. The CBs were leaving, so they supposedly gave them 24 cases of beer, and they got that welder and a flush toilet. And so they were sitting there when we got there. Well, the welder wouldn't work because we needed spark plugs, so I I rode home and had my dad send me spark plugs for it. We got it fired up. So we only had one of the two welders on the whole division base. And so people call us all the time wanting something fixed. Usually it was mess halls who wanted to fix their sinks. So I had one guy on my team who was a welder. So they'd hook up the Jeep and they'd pull the welder down there and fix it. And the cook would give him a case of steaks. So we ended up, one of the units stood down and I went over and signed for and had a 83-foot freezer brought down and hooked up on the end of our bar. We had one little building as our bar, so we hooked up the freezer like that right at the back. And so anytime we got meat, well, we threw it in that freezer. We had our own little area where we barbecued, and we ended up usually just fixing our own meals instead of going to the mess hall. It's a lot better anyway. We had a pretty good time, but I also, snipers and rangers are the only two that could wear camouflage fatigues at that time, so they were a premium. You could trade a pair of fatigues just about anything. So we had good trading material to get stuff we needed. And so we were there about 6 months, and we finally decided we had running water, had a big shower room and everything, and so we decided we're going to build ourselves a flush toilet. So we dug a cesspool and piped it all in and poured a slab and put the toilet in and put running water to it. And so we had one of the two flush toilets on the base. The only other one was a commanding general. You don't realize how great that is until you don't have one. It's a good morale booster. But anyway, that was kind of the way the whole year went. And it was a lot of fun. And I thought we accomplished a lot, too. And I wouldn't trade that year for anything. I thought that was...
You mentioned training snipers, and I guess the natural question that I should ask for the sake of our listeners is, what are the important things that you were training them to do? What did it take at that time for a sniper to really be good at his duty in Vietnam? What were the things that you were trying to impart to these guys?
Well, we trained them to be employed in pairs. One would have a rifle and one would have a telescope or a spotting scope. That's how they were supposed to be employed. And they were supposed to go out at night or be put in somewhere where they could find a hide and build themselves a hide where they're camouflaged in and just observe. And if they got the opportunity to engage the enemy, they would engage them and then get up and move. They didn't stay there. They'd move somewhere else and then extract them as soon as good. So we trained them that, but primarily what we trained them in is marksmanship. The Army, at that point, did not train their soldiers very well in marksmanship. They didn't teach them basics. So he was like taking a grass green kid who he had gone through basic training, and he knew how to pull the trigger on a rifle, but if he hit something, he didn't know why, and if he missed it, he didn't know why. So we trained them to hit targets out to 900 yards. We used what we call the M14, the semi-automatic service rifle. We were the first to use that rifle in sniping. Most of the rifles used were Winchester or Remington bolt-action rifles. That's what the Marines used in their sniping. But we used the M14, and we had a 3x9 power Redfield scope mounted on the rifle with a camming device. So when you zeroed the rifle to 300 yards with your crosshairs, you were automatically zeroed all the way up to 900, because when you turned your scope to a higher power, it cammed itself on the receiver and lowered itself, and you're automatically zeroed all the way up to 900. Well, the way you did that is you had two stadium marks, one above and below the crosshair, and the stadium marks fit your enemy from the head to the waist. So when you put the scope on a soldier, you cammed the scope until the head and waist fit between the stadium marks. That meant you were zeroed at that range. And out to about 600 yards, it was almost guaranteed a first round hit, because you were in a foxhole, or you were covered in a supported position, and you're squeezing the trigger, and you're zeroed, and you got a guy on a spotting scope watching, and he sees what happens. He's reading the wind for him to give him windage and so on to get the chance to shoot. And shooting that semi-automatic, he'd go bang, he'd give you a direction, and go bang again, which you couldn't do with a bolt gun. So I was not sold on semi-automatic sight. Thought it had to be a bolt gun to be a sniper rifle. Well, I found out it doesn't. It was a very effective sniper rifle, and the system we had worked very well. But these kids would come in. I'd talk to them the first thing and tell them by the time they're leaving, they were going to be hitting man-sized targets out to 500 yards on every shot. And you could just see them, oh, yeah. We've heard this kind of stuff before. Yeah. Well, by the time they were done, they were. And then the coaches working with them, and they were having contests between them. See, we shot at metal targets. A half-sized metal silhouette was painted white. When you hit it, you could hear it and it would make a ding. So after you shot him, well, you went down and painted him, and you started all over again. So you knew whether he hit the target or not. By the time these kids went back to the field, they were champing at the bit to get back out there and try it, because they finally learned something, and they could actually hit something with a rifle. So it was very encouraging for us, and especially me, to see this transformation took place in these kids. Because when they would come in from the field, they'd come in every once in a while, go to their back to their battalion area, just for stand down for a day or two. Well, they didn't want to go to their battalion area. They wanted to come to the sniper school area so they could talk to the NCOs, tell war stories. And it's amazing the transformation took place in these kids at that point. So that was very rewarding.
I feel like I need to ask you this, and I know you're not looking to pat yourself on the back and not looking for attention, but it occurs to me, if that was the case, if you took in guys that were very green and might have been a hazard to themselves and others out in the battlefield, and you turned them into guys who could be very effective at this task, that the work you did probably saved a lot of American lives. Is that how you feel? Was that why you were doing it?
No, I was doing it because it was my job, but I enjoyed doing it because it was doing something that I understood and believed in. I'm not sure that it saved a lot of American lives the particular year that I was there, because, like I say, there wasn't a whole lot of contact. Really didn't have that many kills the year I was there. Now, the first year that we sent a team over to the 9th Infantry Division in the Delta, they had a tremendous successful year making kills. I mean, if we're talking about kills, I guess you shouldn't be talking about kills, but basically they had a lot of targets. And at school, a lot of instructors also sniped. My division, the general, wouldn't let the instructors go to the field. He says, it's not your job to snipe, it's your job to train. And so we didn't get to go to the field. We didn't do any sniping.
But there would be some close calls for Lonus Wigger in Vietnam. We'll get to that when we come back. Plus, 8 years after his first Olympic gold, after surviving two tours in Vietnam, he won gold again in Munich. And he'll tell us about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up, and I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with rifle legend Lonis Wigger, a two-time Olympic gold medalist. He lives in Colorado Springs now, where he volunteers at the U.S. Olympic Training Center. There's a great tour you can take there, by the way, if you ever find yourself in that neck of the woods. Mr. Wigger is originally from the tiny town of Carter, Montana, and it was one of his grade school classmates, Barbara Troisi, who introduced us. Thanks, Barbara. You'll find a photo of those two on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. In between his Olympic appearances, Lonis had two tours of duty in Vietnam. And you've shared what some of those assignments were. I guess I have to ask you the obvious question. Did you ever have moments there where you felt that your life was really in danger, that you might not make it home to see your wife and kids again or ever compete in another Olympics?
Yeah, a couple of times. I wasn't in the field a lot, but I was in the field quite a bit the first tour and got shot at. And in our compound, they would shoot recoilless rifles at us, which were used kind of like mortars. They'd set up in a tree line. They'd lob three or four in. A lot of times they'd land in the compound. The night before I left the Delta, we were right in the middle of Tet, and we got a shelling from recoilless rifles. My roommate was a bird dog pilot. He flew as a spotter pilot, and the airfield was about 5 miles out. And he was getting ready to go out and fly the plane that night. He'd sent the crew chief around the back to get the Jeep parked in front of our hooch. And we had a little revetment wall about 3 feet high right across in front of us. That Jeep was sitting there. He went inside and was running. And about that time, I was standing in my room in my underwear. This first round hit in the compound, and I zipped out the door. And normally we went to the corners where we had bunkers. That's where you went to. You know, of course, we had a big fence around us and so on. That's where we went to right away if we had an attack. Well, the sergeant major lived in the hooch next to me, and he and I were getting pretty short. So we built a little short-timer bunker kind of in between our two hooches, which is only about 3 or 4 feet high and just room for a couple of people. Well, that first round hit, and I was in the short-timer bunker, and I'm laying there, and I hear this round come in and hit the Jeep. And the Jeep wasn't more than 20 yards from me, and had that revetment wall, and hit that Jeep, blew up and was burning. And I'm laying here in this short-timer bunker, and all of a sudden, here come people into the bunker. We must have got five of them in there, and they're all laying on top of me. It didn't bother me a bit. So as soon as the shelling stopped, when we jumped up and ran in and got my rifle and went to the command bunker, so the doc came in and he said, so-and-so is down back in the bunker. He says, he's been wounded, and he's only been there about a week. He says, I'll go back and get him. So they went and got him, so everyone brought him into the command bunker, and they had him in there, and they couldn't do anything for him. He died shortly. In the meantime, they'd call for a medevac chopper to come in and pick him up. Well, he died, and so the commander there says, Wigger, he says, get a Jeep. I want you to take the body out to the airfield and put it on that helicopter coming in. And I thought to myself, he's dead. He doesn't need to go out till tomorrow. We don't know what's coming. They're ground attacking all over the country at bases. And we were expecting to get a ground attack. So two other guys volunteered to go with me. So we got a Jeep, we loaded the body in and zipped out to the airfield. And I expected to get ambushed on the way. We got out there, and the helicopter just got in and landed, so we got up, drove up to it, and we got the body loaded, and there were local Vietnamese that were trying to get on the helicopter. They didn't know where it was going. They just wanted to get away, you know, and they were trying to get off, and they kept kicking them off and pushing them off and everything until they could get off the ground. I remember when they took off, they still had a couple of them hanging on to the skids. One of them went up about 20 feet before it finally dropped off. It went on, and so we jumped back in the Jeep and zipped back to the compound, still expecting to get an ambush. We didn't. We got back, and so that was a pretty scary last night for me. Getting shot at down there, it makes you think a little. A
couple broad questions I want to ask you, just because I think it's important to get perspective for someone who lived during this time and did what you did. I'm guessing that you've been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., and seen those 58,000-plus names. What does that mean to you? And when you think back on that time and what you did and what all those names on that wall did, how do you think they should be remembered? What's the significance of that today?
I have seen the memorial, and it's really something to see. I've looked at it quite a bit and found names of people that I knew, some friends and so on. So it really does make you wonder. But I guess what really upsets me about the whole thing is we had that war won, and we blew it. The media blew it. After the Tet Offensive, they were in bad shape. We had them. But the media here said we lost the Tet Offensive. We didn't lose the Tet Offensive. We had them exactly at that point where we wanted them. And the fact that we go into wars and we don't try to win anymore. And you can see the same thing in Afghanistan and Iraq. We go in and people get killed and we pull out and we haven't done anything. We haven't accomplished anything because we don't go to win. If you're not going to go to win, you shouldn't go. That's why I feel about it. There's no reason why we couldn't have won that war over there. We'd have went ahead and bombed Hanoi and bombed the supply route that they run down through. That's where they infiltrated. That's where they came down by the hundreds. But you couldn't go over there and do anything. It's so stupid. If you're going to fight a war, you fight to win. And I think most of the military people felt that way. But we weren't allowed to win. And it's even worse now. Engagement rules are just unbelievable. You get shot at in Afghanistan, he shoots at you out of a building, he drops his gun and walks out, you can't do anything. That's the engagement rule. Unless they shoot at you and you see him, you can't return the fire. That's crazy. I'm glad that I'm not over there involved in that anymore. People aren't going to like what I said, but that's the way it is. You know, I'm old enough, I can say what I want.
Well, and you come out of this situation, and I'm sure both times you got home from Vietnam to see your wife and kids again had to be special. And then as you go back to a third Olympic Games in Munich in 72, I imagine you had a perspective that not many of those Olympians had, having been a sniper instructor, having been in combat, having seen that Jeep blow up not far from you and knowing how close you came. Here you are in Munich when the infamous hostage situation arises. And you saw that firsthand? You saw what happened there?
Pretty much. First of all, I got back in December of 71, and I tried to get back to the marksmanship unit, and the colonel that was in charge at that time didn't want me there. He didn't want me or Foster. He felt like we were not spiffy enough. We weren't military enough for him. And he figured he could take any airborne troops and make international target shooter champions out of them. Well, obviously that's not true, but that's what you're working with. He left in February. I was assigned to the basic training battalion, Fort Jackson, as an executive officer. I was there about 2 months. And they changed. We got a new colonel in at the marksmanship unit. I'd gone over there on one weekend and shot a match against the team that previous colonel said that I couldn't compete with anymore, and I won the match. But anyway, I met the new colonel there. He walked up to me and said, "You want to come back to shoot you?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to." And he said, "I'll do what I can." He was able to finagle it and get me orders, and so the old colonel signed out, the new colonel signed in, and I signed in right after him into the unit, so I was back. But it was February. We had trials in, like, June, and I hadn't shot for quite a while, so I knew that it was going to be tough. Well, the two best small-bore shooters in the world were at the marksmanship unit at that time, Jack Ryder and Lanny Basham, and they'd been there training, and you only take two small-bore. So my chances of making the team small bore were pretty slim, and I knew one of us wasn't going to make the team. It'd probably be me. But they had two more slots for 300-meter centerfire rifle. So I started training 300-meter. I figured that was my best shot at making the team. So I trained, and I made the team, and then trained all summer. And when I went to Munich, that's what I shot, was the 300-meter centerfire rifle. So they won the gold and silver in small bore, and I won the gold in 300-meter, primarily because I changed my attitude a little bit and decided that I'm going to go for the one that I think I can make the team. But yes, going back to the what happened in Munich, fortunately, the shooting events were over at the time because they would have canceled the shooting just because it was guns. You know, that's what would happen. But we were finished. I think we were finished like 1 or 2 days. I had been to a party at one of the shooters' houses that evening and came back. The guy dropped me off at the village, and I didn't want to walk all the way around and come in the gate, so I just climbed the fence. It was pretty close to where I lived. I just climbed the fence and went in and went to bed. Well, that same night is when the Palestinians climbed the fence just about the same place I did. They had athlete sweats on. They climbed the fence and come in. They went in the building where the Israelis were, up on the third or fourth floor. And that's when they got them all together, herded them together, and killed one or two of them. And then the next morning they were able to get a vehicle and they brought them down. And, of course, by that time, the next morning, word was all around. We were all standing outside watching it. And they were within 100 yards of me. And I saw them bring them out and put them on a bus. And there were like four of them that had masks on, who knew who they were. And here I am sitting there being a former sniper and instructor and a target shooter and knowing what it would take. Of course, nothing was being done. And they wouldn't, of course, do anything in the village anyway. But they took them on the bus and took them to the airfield. So that's when it happened. So, yeah, I was pretty close to the first hand. Yeah, it is something. It's unbelievable, quite frankly. In those days, we just didn't have the security that we needed. We never needed it, really, before that. And, you know, like a couple of days before that, third or fourth cousin of mine from North Dakota who was in the military, was stationed in Germany. He found out I was in the village. He'd come in, climbed the fence, and come in to see me a couple of days before that. And, you know, you just didn't think about it, that happening. Of course, that changed things from that point on now that it was. You have maximum security everywhere. And I think they canceled the games the next day for a day, and they had a big memorial in the stadium, and then they went ahead and finished the games. Like I said, I was thankful that I was done and the shooting events were finished, because I know what they're thinking. There wouldn't have been any more shooting events at that point.
I know we're getting short on time here, and there's a lot of your career that we haven't touched on. I want to hit the high points with you, but I guess one thing real quick that we should touch on is you were going to be going to the Olympics in 1980. They were supposed to be in Moscow in Russia, and here we are in 2014, and we have the Winter Olympics in Russia, in Sochi. Does that bring back any of those feelings that you remember from 1980?
Of course, I'd been there and had my opportunities, but there's a lot of people in that 80 team that never got to go to Olympics. And they didn't get to go. And it was so stupid. What President Carter tried to do was just unconscionable, quite frankly. And there was no reason. They weren't going to approve anything by a boycotting, but they did. And they were talking about boycotting this year, too, and some people wanted them to. But I don't think you can boycott. I don't think you can give in to those kind of people. I think you've got to face it, do what you need to do to prevent it, and go. Otherwise, you're going to live in your home behind your fence, scared all your life. You can't do anything. So, no, if I was on this Olympic team, I'd go. Now, I might not let my family go to live out somewhere, but if I was going in the village and to the venues and participating, no question I'd go.
And I know I don't want to insult the rest of your career by glossing over it here, but you stayed in the Army for 26 years, and you continued to teach marksmanship. I'm curious, in all that time at Fort Benning, did you ever sneak your way onto one of those famous jump towers they have there and try to parachute down from 200 feet up?
No, I was smarter than that. But I did. I had a really great career, and like I say, 1980, I made the team. We didn't get to go. Our Olympic trip was to China, so we did get to go to China and shoot. But I formed the junior rifle program at Fort Benning in the mid-70s, and I ran that until I left. We had a very, very successful program, and we had the best team in the country, junior team in the country at the time. We won everything. A lot of the kids that I trained, maybe not necessarily I trained, but our group trained, went on to military academies, went on and made international teams and won medals. At one time, I think there were counted up something like 30 kids that had gone on and got college degrees and shot in the universities and in the military academies. I felt like, you know, I had accomplished something there with that, and we had an excellent program.
You've been here in Colorado Springs for more than a quarter century now, continuing here at the Olympic Training Center. Give us a quick nutshell sketch of what you do here and why you do it.
Well, I left the Army in 87, and they offered me the job. They had built this facility, I think, in 85, and they offered me the job to run the program here, which meant I would be a staff member of the NRA. They were our governing body at the time, but I was in charge of the program here, the coaches and the training program and that sort of thing. And I kept that job for about 5 years. They had a big blow up in the NRA and people fired and so on. And we had a lot of people that wanted to get rid of the NRA as our governing body. They felt like if we formed our own governing body, we could raise funds better, easier. That's what happened. And at that point, about 1993, they had a coup. We got together the USOC. USOC threw the NRA out of the federation. So that meant we had to form a new federation. So that was in process, but about that time, since I worked for the NRA, it fired everybody that worked, and then they hired most everybody back. I didn't get hired back, so I lost my job in the coup. So I went ahead and did some other things, but I decided to stay in Colorado Springs. And then later on, about, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, I came back and participated in things, and so I try to make myself to the point where they can't get rid of me, so I'm a full-time volunteer now. Mm-hmm. And I do whatever I can do to help and promote. I handle all of the firearms forms for foreign athletes as they come in the country. I have to take care of all that. I'm also the president of the Alumni Association. So if I can get myself in case where they have to have me, see, they won't kick me out. So I have a place to go every day.
I know when you've got Olympic gold medals, maybe you're not waiting for a crystal trophy somewhere. But a few years ago, they decided to make you another trailblazer again. No shooter had ever been inducted in the Olympic Hall of Fame, the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame. And they decided to put you in that class, in that category, the greatest Olympians ever. What did that mean to you? What was that experience like?
Well, I don't know how you explain it. I mean, it's just something that doesn't happen to shooters. I mean, you know, most people in this country don't even know shooting is an Olympic sport. And the media, of course, never covers shooting sports because it's guns. So you don't receive much media attention. Email was what helped me get elected. I was nominated. people have been trying to get me nominated for quite a while. My son, one of them, every time he came out here, he was over USOC talking to the lady, to the point where when she seen him coming, I think she locked the door. But, you know, wanting something to be done. Somehow or other, in 2008, I was placed on the list. I think it was like 18 on the list. They were going to pick 8, I think, something along that line. I had a gal working here, and she sent an email out to everybody who belonged to USA Shooting to go online and vote for me. Because the voting from the people was like 20%. Former Olympians could vote. To start out with, the first week or so, my name was on practically every page a couple of times. Then later on, Robinson, the basketball player from San Antonio, the one that went to Navy, he kind of took over and pushed me aside there a little bit. But the gal that I was talking about went to the meeting in Chicago. She did call me. She said that I'd been selected. I thought she'd pull my leg. I didn't think it was any way. It turned out that I got the second most votes to be inducted. Probably the epitome, climax of my career.
Well, I can see the emotion in your eyes as you talk about that. And as we bring this to a close, first of all, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for representing our country. You've done that about as much as anybody possibly could. So I guess the last question I have for you is, what are you most proud of? And what do you hope that your legacy is? Because so many people, especially in the shooting world, look up to you. And your kids have caught the shooting bug and are passing that on to other generations. What are you most proud of, and what do you hope people remember your name for?
Well, that's a pretty tough question. I've never even thought about a legacy. All I think about is what I have to do tomorrow. And I still am active in shooting, not at that level anymore, but I do shoot the NRA Nationals at Camp Perry every summer. And in fact, this summer, my three kids, my daughter was on the 88 Olympic team. My three kids have shot, and the other two went Eastern Kentucky on a shooting scholarship. We were able to get them all together at Camp Perry this year, and we shot as a four-man team, only the second time we ever did that. We ended up coming in second place in the open category, so I was pretty proud of that. It made the whole summer worthwhile, so pretty proud of that happening. And as far as trying to name something that stands out, that's pretty tough. I've had a lot of ups. I forget the downs. A lot of good things happened. I got to see a lot of the world. My wife was able to travel with me quite a bit. She says, yeah, I've been everywhere, but the only thing I've ever seen is all the best shooting ranges in the world. So, you know, we've been fortunate. We've been lucky to travel the world, see everything. I haven't found anywhere in the world I'd rather be than here, and I'm glad to be here. I don't really care to travel over there anymore. I'd like to be able to come in here every day and help out wherever I can, and I don't coach anymore. I tried that for a while, but there wasn't enough people that had money enough to make it worthwhile, so I tried it for a while and didn't work. But I don't get involved in the coaching of the kids here. If one of them comes to me and talks to me and asks me, I'll help them. I'll tell them what I think. I know what it takes to win. I think I can teach that to them. You got to be a winner first to learn how to win. You know, you have to know that. And I can still teach that. But like I say, I don't push myself on anybody. If they want to come to me, I'll help them all I can. But I think probably if I had to name one, picking the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame is probably the epitome of it all.
That is Lonis Wigger, 2-time Olympic gold medalist and 26 years in the U.S. Army, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. If you'd like to see his gold medals as they're displayed at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Back to the World War II generation next time when we remind you again that freedom is not free.